And no, it is not the burning platform, but I am Phumi Mashego and having a very special conversation with somebody I fell in love with 2 days ago. And I thought I'm definitely bringing him into the studio because I think Mr. David Hirsch, Mr. or Professor, somebody doctor. Just told me today that neither. Doctor, neither, none of the above. How do you David, want though. How do you David. Want people to know who you
if,
are?
If it's going to be Mr., then it should be Doctor, but actually it should be David, and then you don't have to worry.
Then you don't have to worry about all those honorifics. We're South African, we love honorifics. Sometimes they're fake, but we absolutely love them. But I do start by saying I fell in love with you 2 days ago, because I did meet you 2 days ago at an interesting breakfast session that, honestly, sometimes I think I'm invited to like plump up the numbers of the diversity quota in the room. But the main part of what interests me is your work as a sociologist, and in particular, the work that you've done documenting and studying the rise of anti-Semitism now in the 21st century, which if you'd asked anybody, I think even 3 years ago, would have said to you, that's a little bit passé. I don't know if this is a thing, but over the past couple of months, particularly with October 7th, we have seen a ramp up of what looks like anti-Semitism and sometimes a mischaracterization. So let's start with that. What is your definition of what this new age anti-Semitism looks like?
Okay. Well, it's really a pleasure to be here. And it's great to know you too. So the work on anti-Semitism, I brought two books with me to talk about and to push a little bit.
I'm going to hold up the little... So that's, group of books, which is the second group.
So that's so the, I'll hold that's it up the later. Second book. Those three books are the second book, if that makes sense.
I'll hold it up later.
And the first one I brought was called The Rebirth of Antisemitism in the 21st Century. And I was really pleased to talk about that because in a way it was published and I kind of forgot about it and I didn't really talk about it much because 7th of October happened really soon afterwards and then the world seemed to change quite a lot, although it's quite an interesting question about whether and how it changed. And then we got straight into that new book that you just held up. So very happy to go back to the Rebirth book. And in a way, the Rebirth book told the story of how the world was ready to think about what happened on the 7th of October in the way that it did, or in the ways that it did. So I was first... I could tell the story back a long time, actually. I could go back to the mid-80s when I was like a student activist, a kind of left-wing student activist. And within that far-left universe, these fights were already happening about Zionism, and people were saying that Zionism equals racism, that Zionism is a form of racism, and therefore... because Jewish societies on campus are Zionist and therefore they are incompatible with the values of the student movement, and Jewish societies should be banned and should not be allowed in student unions. And so we said we think that Jewish societies are just societies of Jews and, you know, they're not constituted to be racist, and that... the action of banning Jewish societies was actually really, really hostile. And we said also that it may be true that, you know, quite a lot of Jews are Zionist, or that lots and lots of Jews define their identity in relation to Israel, or they have some kind of support for Israel in their identity. But that does not make them into racists. It does not make the overwhelming majority of Jews... it does not give them values that are incompatible with the student union in Britain or with the culture in South Africa or whatever. And to say that it does was, it felt to the people involved, incredibly hostile. So they were saying to Jews and to nobody else, you can't have a communal organization because the values of your community are incompatible with the normal values of democratic society and everyone else's values. So you could have, you know, a Muslim society or a Hindu society or a Chinese society or a chess society or a cricket society, any society you could have, but the Jewish society was Zionist and therefore incompatible, and you can't have that. So I remember back to the, you know, 1984-ish, having those fights with, as someone on quite, you know, in a, quite a marginal place on the far left, having that argument with other people who were also marginal in the far left. And at that time, even the official student unions were not interested. You know, the National Union of Students in Britain never was interested in banning Jewish societies or anything. So it was a really marginal thing. But for us, it was important. And so in a way, my journey and my understanding of anti-Semitism has been watching the mainstreaming of that fight that was happening on the very far left and incidentally also on the very far right, although obviously I wasn't involved in that and I wasn't seeing that up close, although we saw it up close in another sense. And it became important sort of in the 90s. In Eastern Europe, there was a kind of, you know, a rebirth of a sort of far-right fascism. But the story has been a story of the mainstreaming of that same kind of anti-Semitism, which banned Jewish societies. But also, it's not even a straight line, because that stuff came really from a kind of 1970s Zionism equals racism ethic. It went into the 80s, but then it all calmed down. And I think the reason it calmed down is because there was a peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The official organizations of the Palestinians, the PLO and Fatah, which was the main faction, made this really important statement. I can't remember exactly when. I think in the late 80s, when they said, we're not anymore for the destruction of Israel and we're not anymore for getting rid of Jews from the Middle East, but we want to live alongside Israelis and we want a two-state solution. So in a sense, especially with hindsight, you could say that they accepted the existence of Israel. Mm. And some people would say now that they were therefore Zionist, that instead of official Palestinian leadership became Zionist. I mean, I wouldn't say that to myself.
I want to, and I know that a lot of this conversation has come back into the mainstream part of the conversation because of what is happening now with the war in the Middle East and the escalation of tensions.
Yes.
But I grew up here in South Africa in the 80s and the 90s, which was a very tumultuous time, which had a lot of nationalist and self-determination activity happening, yeah. And as we know what the history is. But I was a full-grown adult in university, as it were, when I first encountered the term Zionist the way you use it. Because here in South Africa, when I was growing up, I thought about AmaZayoni, and they are an African Christian,
yes,
sect, as it were, right?
Yes.
So that, and even now, I think there are many South Africans who that term is a little bit like strange.
Yes.
And the ideology, what's your definition that you would give to a young 16-year-old South African who's kind of going, I come from deep rural Limpopo.
Yeah.
And what I know about Zionists is the ZCC and so how does it suddenly become this thing that's in the center of a war, yeah, in the Middle East?
So it's a really interesting question, because my instinct is to be stubborn and to refuse to answer that question. And let me tell you why.
You're not allowed to. Can't refuse me.
All right, so I promise I will answer that question in a minute. But let me tell you why my instinct is to say I don't want to answer it. And the reason is because, look, Zionism is a thing. And I will tell you about, sorry, I just hit the microphone. I will tell you about what I think it means in a minute. But the, for me, the most kind of hostile way that the term is used is really nothing to do with what it really is, and is nothing to do with the way Jews understand their own political identity and their own nationalism and their own sort of political culture, because what happens, like happened in the example that I just gave about Jewish societies, that Zionism is defined outside of us and by people who are hostile to us. Zionism is defined as racism. And I can have to explain why that is too. It's a very simple kind of logic. So people say that the state of Israel was set up as the state for the Jews, and therefore it's not a state for all its citizens. And so there's this contradiction between a Jewish state and a democratic state, and you have to choose, and Israel chose a Jewish state, and therefore it can't be a democratic state because it excludes non-Jewish citizens from its citizenship. Now, to cut a long story short, the truth is that all states, and I'm going back to my kind of Marxist heritage, which I know you like, all states are contradictory, right? All states claim to be above society and neutral and the place where everybody's interests are negotiated, and there's a civil society and state distinction. So the kind of classic Marxist understanding is to say all states are contradictory and they promise contradictory things and they don't live up to the things that they promise about themselves, and anyway, they promise different things about themselves.
I'm South African. I can tell you a thing or two about a disappointing state.
Right. So my real answer to the to this really simplistic thing about, well, you can't be a Jewish state and a democratic state at the same time, it's contradictory. My real answer is to say, yes, it's contradictory. Isn't that interesting? So let's think about that clear contradiction. And let's think about how the state of Israel came into being with these contradictory tasks. If you like, history gave it these contradictory tasks, both to be a place of safety for Jews and to be a place for the rebirth of Jewish culture, not only after the Holocaust, but also after the expulsion and anti-Semitism of Jews from the great cities all over the Middle East, and also from Russia, from communist Russia, which denied Jews their ability to be Jewish, and which kind of was always tempted to construct Jews as the enemy of the people. And I can go into that more too. But so if you like, history gave Israel this task, which was to be the state for the Jews and a place where Jews could create the capacity for self-defense. But history also gives Israel a completely contradictory task, which is to be a democratic state for all its citizens. So if you like, well, it's not our fault, right? We have these two contradictory things that we need to do. So the question is not to then say kind of gotcha, Israel is a contradiction and it must be racist and not democratic. The interesting thing to do with that is to look at the history of first the Zionist movement and then Israel itself and see how it attempted to fulfill these two contradictory tasks. How was it both Jewish and democratic? And when did it do this really well? When did it combine Jewish and democratic really well? And when did it do it really badly? And which political traditions in Israel do it in interesting ways and which do it in dehumanizing ways? So the normal way to think about the contradictions in a state is to look at how they actually played out in the material world. And the abnormal way to look at contradictions in a state is to use it as a gotcha, to say, aha, therefore, this state is unique and bad and we need to destroy it. Hang on, so that the whole thing was a distraction and I can't remember exactly from what.
From.
So you asked me what Zionism really is. So the reason I'm tempted to refuse to answer is because Zionism is, when we're having a discussion about anti-Semitism anyway, and that's what I'm interested in, that's what my work is about and my books, when I'm interested in anti-Semitism, then the identity of Zionist is put upon me from outside. And the meaning of that identity, when I'm called a Zionist in a hostile way, it's not then up to me to define my own Zionism or my own non-Zionism. It's not up to me to say, what are my politics? How do I understand my relationship with the state of Israel? Because it's thrust upon me from outside and it means you're a Zionist and therefore you're a racist. and therefore you support Israeli apartheid, and therefore in the current moment you are a facilitator of Israeli genocide. So you asked me what is Zionism really, and I will tell you what I think it is. But I also want to insist that in a sense it doesn't matter, because what matters is the Zionism that is thrust upon me by hostile people. And actually in the beginning of race and racism, that is what a kind of classic anti-racist position said. Anti-racism always said that race is not something that's natural and naturally occurring out there in the world. Race is a way of taking particular differences between human beings and grouping them together and then endowing them with huge social significance and making them the markers of huge inequalities of power and wealth and possibilities. Now, that's quite a difficult idea to get your head around, because we're so kind of used to race. Gosh, I imagine, especially in South Africa, we're so used to the idea of race that it becomes normal to think of race as being dark skin, curly hair, whatever. But in the first place, and I used to teach students first year stuff, and I used to say literally that there are social processes that take particular biological differences and make them really significant. And I said, for example, some of you in this room have a second toe that's longer than your big toe, some of you. And I think it's like something 10 or 15% of you. And that's fine, but nobody cares, right? Mm. Nothing is determined by it. There is this biological difference between human beings, but it's not significant and it's not given social significance. Right. Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, somebody came to me and said, well, in my culture, actually, it is quite significant. The thing about
the toe. And
I don't even remember where they were from, but it kind of makes the point, really.
Yeah.
So there's that quite difficult conversation about race. Yeah. And actually, that goes to interesting places, because firstly, race seems naturalized by those social processes. And then actually, anti-racism begins to say, well, firstly, you can't just say, well, race is a fake category and we should just deny it, because it's real, but it's real socially and not naturally. It's real socially and not biologically. So you have to understand that race exists, but it exists as a social process. But still, I want to hold on in some way in my anti-racism to an idea that as well as creating equality between, quote, races, we also hold on to the idea that we need to have a strategic view of getting rid of race, because race is a social process and it's not a helpful social process. So an anti-racism which also questions and deconstructs race. And there's another complexity within that, which is a kind of black consciousness, right, whereby, of course, lots of people say, well, they look at you like, what are you talking about? I'm black and I'm beautiful and I'm proud. And it's
and
a
how
really...
dare you, the one right. thing when I look at myself in the mirror that yeah. I see all the time, yeah. how dare you want to erase that and
Absolutely.
Diminish it and make it nothing?
That's right. And how dare you say that it's nothing but something which came originally from racism, right? I get that completely. But the way I would answer that in this context is simply to say, whatever is your own self-empowering, beautiful black identity, if you're walking down a dark alley at night, or if you're going for a job interview and somebody defines you as black, it, independently of your own self-definition, and they do that in a racist way, then that's not part of your own beautiful
Making.
Way of dealing with the world. It's racism. So in an analogous way, lots of Jews actually have also a very self-empowering and proud relationship to their Zionism and to the State of Israel. That's fine by me. Some of them I kind of like more than others, but that's fine by me. But what's not fine by me is when the identity of Zionism, of Zionist, is pushed onto people with one single meaning. And the one single meaning... Actually, as race does, race makes every black person the same,
yeah.
right? Because the only important thing is their skin color or whatever. And this imposition of Zionism, meaning racism, makes all Jews the same and their Zionism is the same.
So, which brings us full circle to...
What is Zionism, really?
No, well, actually, well, I do wanna, I'm not going to let that go. But I do want to say a thing that we have seen in this discourse, in the political, in the very heated political climate that we're in, particularly with social media, the conflation of, I don't agree with you, you don't agree with me, you're Jewish, therefore you are Zionist, therefore you are bad. You're on the other side. And this, we can disagree without it devolving to that particular thing. And a lot of the time, on the other side, people using any kind of disagreement with their point of view as you're actually anti-Semitic and shutting down a conversation that could lead down interesting paths.
Yep. So let me come at that conversation from a couple of different directions. Firstly, the history of anti-Semitism is interesting because people generally think of Nazism, right?
Absolutely.
The Nazis. And then one of the things about Nazism that was unique in the history of anti-Semitisms was that Nazism racialized Jews in a way that allowed no exceptions, right? So every Jew, no matter who they were, no matter what they said or did, was objectively an enemy of the people
Bad.
And needed to be got rid of. So Nazism didn't allow any exceptions.
Mm, the final solution stuff.
Right. But every previous anti-Semitism did allow for exceptional Jews generally. And if you think about it, most racism and most sexism also allows for exceptions, right? I won't say it because somebody will chop it, right? I don't like, you know, X group. But this one's all right, that one's all right.
Hey!
But I don't...
Need I remind you, you are in South Africa.
Yes.
We have these special blacks.
Which is why, yes, okay.
They call them magical Negroes in America, but anyway.
I'm not present. So for example, in the history, back to where I'm comfortable, in the history of anti-Semitism, right? With religious anti-Semitism, Jews were said to be evil, but if they convert to Christianity, then they're all right, okay? So there was a route offered so that Jews could get out of the...
Redemption.
Yeah, the opprobrium put onto them. Now, it's true that anti-Zionism offers Jews a way out, an exemption. But it does so only if Jews embrace the specific understanding that is offered to them by the anti-Zionist movement. And generally what that means is to say that I completely disavow my relationship to Israel. I have no relationship to Israel. I don't look to Israel. I think Israel is really bad. I think it is a inherently racist or apartheid, or today I think it is inherently genocidal. So whereas there is an exception offered, it's not one that most of us can accept. So let me explain then why, and I will now answer what is Zionism. So Zionism, straightforwardly, I think, is Jewish nationalism in just the same way that one might talk about or to be even more complicated, Jewish nationalism or patriotism or national feeling. So just as you might talk about someone who is a South African and proud of their nation, proud of their South Africanness in one way or another and in more strongly or less strongly, or someone who is proud of their Britishness, more proud or less proud or differently
like
proud.
Like Donald Trump and his friends.
Or, yes, or America, whether you make America great again or whether you support, you know, Kamala's kind of American, the America, really, the American dream, actually.
The American way.
Yeah, yeah. So fundamentally, my position is that Zionism is the same. It's the ways in which Jews thought about creating and being loyal to a Jewish nation. As I've said already, of course... Every nationalism, I think, as far as I know, every nationalism contains people who are quite extreme and quite nasty, right? Every nationalism contains racists, probably, I think. Although that might, I don't know if that's true with kind of African nationalisms, although I suspect it is. But I will again stick in my comfort zone, which is Europe.
Even Prince tells us there's an asshole in every race. It is. It's a Prince lyric.
So whereas there is a nasty end of every nationalism that I know of, there is also a nice end of every nationalism that I know of. And this is quite important because some of us on lefties were kind of brought up to think that nationalism is bad, right? And it, but actually nationalism also contains ways in which a community of common, of looking after each other is created, right? So in the first place, very often, nationhood as a community of self-defense, or a lot of nationalism comes out of colonialism and as a response to colonialism, so anti-colonialist nationalism is the wish to be free as a nation of colonial domination. And it's complicated that because nationalism kind of comes from Europe, well, arguably, or maybe not, that's another whole set of debates. So in a way, you're kind of employing a European idea against European colonialism as a way of getting your freedom. We can come back to that. I can see in your face you'd like to. But also, so a community of self-defense. But like in Britain, the Brits are funny, right? Because one of the real things that they love about themselves and they think is unique in the world, and one of the kind of key things about British nationalism of a nice kind is their National Health Service. And the Brits think that the National Health Service is unique, and they think that the Brits have the best NHS in the world. And so it's an element of British nationalism to say we have this lovely way that if anyone gets sick, they get looked after without having to pay and in a completely equal way, etc. So anyway, the point being that nationalism is a community of mutual care, it can also be a community of exclusion. And in fact,
absolutely,
even the mutual care always has an element of exclusion because who's allowed to use the NHS, right? Not anyone in the world, but only Brits. Mm. So there you go. Nationalism is complicated. And it has different traditions, and so does Zionism, right? So there are some traditions of Zionism which are really awful, right? Which are kind of, you know, Jews who kind of think that they're better than other people, or that they want to kind of deal with the, you know, their neighbors and deal with Arabs in a really kind of harsh and awful way. But on the other hand, there are other traditions of Zionism of Jews who decided that one of the key ways of addressing anti-Semitism, the anti-Semitism that they felt in Europe, but not only in Europe, as I said, also across the Middle East where Jews were pushed out.
Yeah.
And interestingly, people...
Yemen.
Yeah. So people who say that Israel is unique because it's an ethnic state and therefore it's not a democratic state, it's a really weird position because pretty well every state in the Middle East defines itself in relation to an ethnicity, right? So, like, a number of the states that actually have it in their name, you know, the Syrian Arab Republic or whatever it's called. And so that's kind of all right to
Saudi Arabia.
Get rid of the colonial power with an ethnic nationalism. And then, of course, the Jews found that they weren't really included in this idea of an Arab state or in Iran in this idea of a Muslim state. And it's just really weird when people say that Israel is unique because it's ethnically defined. Well, all of the states in the Middle East are ethnically defined. All of the states in the Middle East are ethnically defined. And in fact, again, Israel is complicated because within the state of Israel itself, there are equal rights for every citizen. And so there's this distinction between ethnic nationalism. Whoops, I've done it again. Ethnic nationalism and civic nationalism, right? So South Africa is interesting. Because South Africa might be unique because South Africa was the one place where it was absolutely and explicitly civic nationalism which replaced colonialism and apartheid. So because South Africa has got these different communities and some people thought they were nations and some people didn't, And the you know, the Rainbow Nation and the anthem is in four languages. So South Africa was created as an absolutely deliberate, explicit civic nationalism, which said South African citizenship does not depend on and is not defined in relation to any particular ethnicity. Mm. Right?
Well, look, we start out part of what was the basis of our current constitution, the Freedom Charter, saying South Africa belongs to all who live in it. Today, when you talk to various politicians who are well represented in our parliament, and when you are in the public discourse, as it has happened all over the world, there is much polarization and the pulling apart of, and often ideologies that are mixed in lots of ways. It's very strange. And you alluded earlier to how when you were a student, the far left had particular sets of constructs which were very similar to the far right, which,
well,
you know.
But in terms of their anti-Semitism,
But in terms of their anti-Semitism, but today even more, right, when you see it all over the world and how there has been a huge push of a extremist far-right movement sweeping through Europe, an extreme religious conservative right movement in the Middle East, kind of the Islamists and the jihadists, and where all of these things seem to clash in the Middle East is poor Israel.
Let me just tie up the thing about nationalism. So the interesting thing about nationalism, and you said it, is that you can have this idea that South Africa is this kind of uniquely civic nation, or it's at the end of the spectrum, is completely the civic nation, and Israel is at the other end, is the ethnic nation, the nation for Jews. But the truth is that both Israel and South Africa have elements of both, right? That they both have elements of civic nationalism and elements of ethnic nationalism. And I think all nationalisms do. They have elements in the state, but also traditions in their thinking. And they can shift, right? So you could imagine, and I believe there are some political forces in South Africa that really want to create a kind of ethnic nationalism in South Africa, or at least a much more exclusive nationalism. And of course, in Israel, there are people who are much more concerned about really guaranteeing the rights of minorities, and there are other people who are not. And this is true across the Arab states and across Europe and everywhere, so that civic and ethnic nationalism are not two completely different kinds of nation, but they are elements within every nation, and that's important. So to follow you onto that big question about what's going on in the world, so I like to use the word populism, and populism doesn't mean just that some people or some parties are popular, right? That's not what it means in my mind. What it means is that populism is a way of defining yourself and your politics in relation to the people. And the way you do it, and the way you can see Donald Trump does this really clearly, he talks about that he positions himself as speaking for the people and against the kind of coastal, liberal, metropolitan, educated elites. So it's a worldview in which there is the people, which is a kind of one lovely, authentic, beautiful thing. But the people is held down by a kind of unseen elite,
down, you know,
set of elites and who do them down, and quite often in ways that you can't even see. And one of the characteristics of the liberal elites that populism kind of invents or that populism that it talks about, one of the things about those liberal elites is that they portray themselves as really nice, right? So this is the sort of Trumpy view of the coastal liberal elites, right? They talk about anti-racism, they talk about being nice, they talk about sharing their money, But really, all of that talk about the lovely democratic state is in fact a cover
to lull you.
Yes, it's a cover for really they're selling your jobs to China and they're doing all sorts of awful things to you. And I'm here as the spokesperson of the people to rescue you. And so a couple of things follow from that. One is that notion of the people and the elites is actually really different from a more old-fashioned notion of the democratic state. Because the democratic state is complex. And it has all kinds of things in the constitution and civil society. And there are all sorts of ways in which every kind of diverse interest gets represented in the state. And never completely, never properly, always partially. But in this complexity of the democratic state, everyone finds ways to get their voice heard.
We're striving.
Right. So that's the idea of democracy. But populism is something else. Populism says that the democratic state is fake. It's faked by the elites. And therefore, the people is just one mass of authentic loveliness. But it must be represented by a single voice. And that's why populism often gets these kind of strong, charismatic leaders to speak for them, because there's no complex way of having everybody's voices kind of put together in a state, because the state is fake. So you have one person telling the real truth and the authentic truth and speaking for the people. And very often, populist leaders are a little bit kind of empty, right? And so they enable everyone to pour their own fantasies and wishes and everything into the persona of the leader.
Yeah.
And I think that populism is related to the kind of early development of the kinds of 20th century totalitarian movements that were the most frightening thing that the earth has ever seen, actually. to wipe my own smile off my face, right? That this idea of the leader, this idea of the revolt against the hidden elites and the kind of conspiracies, there is a very dark place that populism can go. And you're right, it's on the rise.
So as a person who studies society, whose real love has been in this development of how societies organize themselves, how we are, how we, you know, do you think the pendulum is swinging, because it's forever swinging, back to a place where there's a different type of demagogue that is running a scam, as it were, in our society that is very divisive, looking for the crevices in that heaving mass that we are as the people to exploit, to gain all of this power? Is that where we're going back to? Is that what this rise of anti-Semitism looks like? Because that's, you know, kind of, if I think about what happened in Russia with the pogroms,
with Germany.
Eventually, that's what it was, right? It was these individuals who rose to this power and were able to pull apart.
So Russia with Ukraine, with the pogroms, but also later on in communist Russia.
Absolutely.
Which people often don't know much about,
but
communist Russia and actually East Germany and Poland, the Polish state, the East German state, and these are places very close to the Holocaust, and they had big anti-Semitic movements, government-led, only 24 years after the end of the Holocaust, right? Anyway, I can talk more about that, but more generally, the connection between anti-Semitism and populism is kind of quite straightforward. And it is this, that populism boils down in the end to a kind of conspiracy fantasy, right? Like they produce this fantasy that the world is actually very simple, that the elites are somehow beholden to this kind of secret conspiracy which lies to the people and which rules by pretending to be nice. Now, the thing about anti-Semitism is that, however you think about it, anti-Semitism has evolved as a way of picturing, giving a face to the evil that we can't necessarily see. And this stems from some traditions of Christianity in the medieval period where, I mean, they were kind of quite cross, right? Because they had this lovely new religion and this lovely universal religion for the whole of humankind, and the stubborn Jews wouldn't play, right? They wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't be part of it.
They killed Jesus.
Right, so that's the next step, right? Not only would the Jews not play, but they were against it and they were trying to subvert it and they were murdering Jesus. So through these traditions of Christianity, there came this kind of way of thinking of the Jews as something specifically, which is a way of picturing the evil, right? Because Christianity too had this problem. It said, you know, we have the good news, we have this brilliant universal religion, but life is still hard. And, you know, and Jesus did come and was sent by God to save us all, but why are we not saved, right? And actually, populism has the same problem, and the totalitarians of the 20th century all had the same problem, that they offered these huge solutions, but they never arrived. And then when they don't arrive, you have to have a reason. And the reason is always going to be an enemy of the people. So you have the people and you have the big strong man who leads the people. You have the elites who lie to the people. And then you have a hidden enemy of the people. And anti-Semitism works really well as a way of picturing this evil enemy that lurks and hides. And in medieval Christianity, it had kind of claws and horns and an ugly face. And it was often kind of became close to the devil, right? So the pictures of the Jews were like the pictures of the devil. And one of the interesting things about those anti-Semitic images of the Jews is that one of those anti-Semitic images had the Jew as this kind of reasoning evil devil, right? And the Jew would challenge the good, simple Christian with his good, simple faith. The Jew would challenge him with reason,
tempt him with his
with
money.
Arguments. Yes, a little bit like Eve and the snake, right? The Jew would tempt you with reason. And the good Christian would resist reason because he had faith. And so in some variants of this, the Jew and their reason and their modernity and their technology, as they were associated with, became a kind of evil. There are kind of others, but I'm particularly interested in, well, partly because it's quite trendy today to be suspicious of reason, right? In social theory and sociology, in my discipline, people are quite kind of scathing about reason, and some people say that the whole idea of reason is just really another way of doing power. I could go on about that, but I won't.
But now, part of that reason lives in the money and the power,
right?
And capital,
yes.
And the people who make decisions around capital and markets. Here in South Africa, we have something that the politicians love to call white monopoly capital.
Right. Interesting. Because it's not completely mad, right?
Yeah, because we see where who has money and where they are.
And there was a political monopoly of white power, right?
Absolutely.
Like, what, 30 years ago still?
And there's definitely an understanding that, and we've just had an election where money played a very big role in who funds whom. And some of the big funders of some of the big political parties are actually people who come from Jewish backgrounds.
Right.
Because they've got money.
Right.
And they're invested. And so they've paid. And so now this tying of white monopoly capital, this person pulling the strings at the back, being this money,
the kind of secret funders behind the politicians, right?
Absolutely. Has also fed into this particular narrative. And then the war happens and South Africa's government takes a particular stance.
Yep.
And that strife, and for me, which is why this conversation was so important to have, the conflation of all of these pieces to a place where parts of the community of South Africa are now vilified as being Zionist.
Yes. So you mean and then Jewish South Africans,
the
right?
Jewish South Africans take any kind of criticism of Israel and what's happening in Israel as anti-Semitic. And now we are at an impasse.
Okay. So the thing about, like, so firstly, the thing about Jews and money goes back a long way, right? And there are some tiny little parts, kernels of truth in the whole big myth. So there were prohibitions of Jews, for example, in medieval times, from doing various kinds of trades. They were not allowed in. They weren't allowed into the guilds. And the one thing that they developed, also because portable wealth was important to them, they couldn't have like factories and stuff because they might have to run away because things often got hot for them. And so having either expertise and education or kind of portable wealth became important for some people. And so there was a tradition of Jews being in the diamond trade and in money lending and stuff like that. And sometimes the states in Europe and the rich people in Europe made use of that. So they developed a kind of big stereotype of Jews and money. Now, it was never true that all Jews are rich. And it was there are, you know, huge traditions of working class Jews. Of course, a lot of the Jews who died in the Holocaust, for example, were precisely the working class Jews who found it harder to
get out.
Yeah, who didn't have portable wealth and who didn't have maybe that kind of tradition of moving, right?
I think about the scene in Schindler's List, right?
Yeah, with absolutely
people and their gold teeth and yes. their diamonds. And
well, they were saved not by a Jewish capitalist, but by a non-Jewish capitalist, mm-hmm. right? And but in that story, by the clever little Jew who made it possible, right? Who was Stern, the accountant, right? So it's, look, all these stereotypes kind of fly around. And so firstly, there are and always have been poor Jews, and there have been like communist Jews and Jews in the trade union movements and Jews who have united against sweatshops and all those traditions. And secondly, of course, not all rich people are Jewish, right? Now, quite often people who, like the ultra-rich, right, are quite often assumed to be Jewish because they're rich. So the example I gave the other day was Rupert Murdoch, right, who owns the press and controls public opinion and makes loads of money, but he's not Jewish, right? But people kind of assume he is because he, in a way, conforms to this stereotype. And so that's one thing, that it's much less true than we think, right, that lots of people who are rich and important in terms of being able to influence how things happen are absolutely not Jewish. There is all sorts of other money out there, both in South Africa and also in the United States and everywhere else. And then the other thing I would say is that, like, there's an example, right, which is that the Jews dominate Hollywood, people say. And so there was.
And so they control the images that you see in the media, right? And therefore can control what you think.
That's this old image of the Jew controlling minds, right? Like arguing with the good Christian and giving them bad ideas and giving them pornography and other corrupting influences. But listen, you know, again, there is some truth, right? That there were some Jews who came out of Europe who knew how to make movies and who knew music and who knew how to put together a story, right? And there were some clever Jews who went to Hollywood and made movies and they made movies in a kind of universal pattern that they could sell everywhere in the world. So there was a certain kind of Hollywood movie that didn't only speak to people in California, it spoke to everybody because it was a kind of Universal Studios, right? But here's the point. Not all movie makers were Jewish, and the movie makers who were Jewish were not all the same, right? So we talked already earlier on about racism constructing every black person to be the same, or anti-Zionism constructing every Jew to be a Zionist, meaning the same. And in this case, every filmmaker in Hollywood is not said to be, it's not that Steven Spielberg is a Jewish filmmaker, but it is the Jews, you know, the Jews control Hollywood. How do you know? Well, look at Steven Spielberg, look at whatever, MGM, and the truth is that there are different Jewish people who are influential in filmmaking, but they're making their own movies. They're making the movies they love, or they're making the movies that other people love and make them money. And they are not all tentacles of some hidden Jewish hole. And that's the point, right? That the conspiracy fantasy comes when you look at this Jew and that Jew and that, and then you think they must all be working together.
Connect the dots.
Right? And they're not, because that's just not how the world is.
So, I mean, I told you that I could talk to you forever, and I absolutely love every facet of where all of these conversations go. And I wish more people could have more conversations of this nature. Tell us about your book, okay, your books, cool, and where people can find them. And then, yeah, great. I'm going to leave it there.
So if you Google the London Centre for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism, which is a bit of a mouthful, or if you...
We're going to put a link. When we put the podcast up, we'll put a link.
Or if you Google londonantisemitism.com, we have a book series, which we're very proud of, actually, and we just kind of made it happen by good fortune, really. And this is the fifth... These three are the fifth publication in the series. And a little time after the... People know what happened on October the 7th, I hope. I mean, there was this attack on Israeli communities in the place near Gaza, in the place near where Palestinians live in Gaza. And there was about 1,000 people, nearly all the Jews, killed in a day. And it was a big deal, certainly in Israel and certainly for Jews around the world. And it also led to lots of responses which worried us. So some people kind of were excited that the people from Gaza were going into Israel and killing everybody. And they said, you know, I remember a tweet saying, this is what the liberation will look like, right? It will look like violence against Jews. And then some people didn't glorify, but they kind of trivialized it. They said, well, it's true that it's bad, but it's not as bad as the real underlying causes of the violence, which are, you know,
there's
something
a context.
Else. And then other people denied it and said, no, it never happened. There was never any attack on civilians or sexual violence against women. None of it happened. And then the fourth variety that worried people was that it was a kind of false flag operation, that the Israelis did it to themselves somehow. So that, and then there was the war, which was kind of pretty awful. I mean, war is awful, and this war is a particularly awful war, partly because of the way it started and partly because the way it is happening in hugely built-up areas where lots of people live. And so what we did was we put out actually a public call for contributions, and we said to academics and intellectuals and really anybody and feminists, we said, write a short and fairly raw and immediate response to any of that stuff that I just mentioned. And we got lots of responses, and we put together about 35 responses in these three volumes. And what they do is they tell a slightly different story to the kind of stories that are told, I think, in the mainstream. And I don't want to say that everybody got it wrong, because many people were quite smart about what happened and were quite sympathetic to Israel and to Jews. But many people weren't. And so this is a kind of response to that whole conversation.
A raw response to
a contribution to the conversation, really, and a challenge to some of the things that we were worried about. And we were very pleased with ourselves. Well, you know, you know me for 2 days. You know I'm quite pleased with myself a lot. We spent the whole of Christmas, well, you know, we're not too bothered about Christmas, but we spent the whole of our holidays putting that book together, me and Rosa Friedman and other people, and we published that book in May. So the thing happened in October, and we had these three volumes published in May. And that's not such a big deal in the world of journalism or whatever, but in academia it's huge. It's really quick. And so people can read them if they want to have lots of different ways of thinking about what happened on the 7th of October and subsequent events, the war, and the thing that people, you know, talk about when they talk about the genocide in Gaza and all of that stuff. Do get these books. You can get them. So the Studies in Contemporary Anti-Semitism website is our collaboration with Routledge Publishing. I believe that there are quite a lot of copies in South Africa at the moment. It's clever because they print them on demand, and they printed a load. I think this is printed in South Africa. So you can get hold of the books.
So we'll put the link up.
We'll put the link up, and if podcast. We'll help people find the books. And the other one that I talked about was the one before that, the one that I said didn't get enough traction, The Rebirth of Antisemitism in the 21st Century, fantastic. Which in a way was a sort of setting the scene for being able to understand what happened on the 7th of October.
Fantastic. I'm going to make sure that your surname is spelled correctly when we put out the link so that people know how to Google you. And since I've been teaching you some Zulu over the past couple of days, I'm going to end this with the Zulu quote is "Izinto zoniwa umlomo, but zilungiswa futhi umlomo." So, and what that English translation is you ruin things with your mouth, but you can also fix them only with the mouth. And so open conversations for me are incredibly powerful and useful tools for finding each other in the mess that is humanity. So thank you for coming and chatting with me.
It's a pleasure to meet you, really.
Fantastic.